ain't working.
That's the way you do it.
You play the guitar on the MTV. That ain't working. That's the way you do it.
Get your
money for nothing
and your chicks for free.
Money for nothing.
Chicks. See, that's what we get. We get money for nothing.
So, Bob, what are you saying?
I'm saying Brendan Clifford's got to work for his money.
Oh, okay.
We don't have to.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I know.
The $3 in my pocket.
Yeah, pretty much. 836, Brendan Clifford, New Hampshire Fish and Game, non-game and endangered wildlife program. Wildlife diversity biologist. How are you, Brendan?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Man, tough job. So you mean wildlife diversity biologist. So you have to have a Hispanic rabbit, an Asian rabbit. You got to make sure that this is that what we're talking about?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, don't encourage him, Brendan.
Okay.
Do not encourage him.
This is why it was not a four-year bio major, okay? So what does a wildlife diversity biologist do at Fish and Game?
Well, here in the non-game program, we have less than 10 staff, and we have a lot of endangered species in the state. So we're all kind of in charge for different species projects. So me personally, I work a lot with snakes. I also do some stuff with a bird on the beach, the piping plover.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'll help out with some other projects. But we all kind of have our hands in different projects, and we try to take care of all the endangered species that we have, as well as some at-risk species as well.
So what are you, like a frustrated herpetologist, or did you draw the short straw?
A little of both, right? I started working on the piping plover project when I first got out of college, and then I switched to snakes, but then I went back to plovers as well because I had some familiarity with it. So I do a little of – birds are really just, you know, feathered reptiles anyways, so it's mostly a herpetologist job.
They're kind of cool. I mean, the piping plovers. I mean, they're we always see them, you know, down on the coast, and you see the nest. And yeah, they're a little adorable. I mean, are they threatened or are they endangered? Or are they special concern? Which category?
So they are endangered in New Hampshire, but they're also across their entire range, the Atlantic coast. They're federally threatened.
Oh.
So there it's even a higher level than just it being state endangered. Just because they nest, you know, on the beach where that's where all the people are. So mm-hmm. They're always going to have that problem of coming into contact with people and all the different things that go on the beach.
I hate to ask, but are people pretty good about giving the birds their space, or are they jerks about it, trying to go up and, you know, spook the nest and get selfies and do that stuff?
For the most part, people are good. A lot of people actually don't even really know that they're there. They'll see the signs, but they've never seen a bird because they're sand colored and they really, you know, blend in really well.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, we'll get a, you know, single incidents here and there where people are frustrated with the protection efforts because it's, you know, put some restrictions on the beach. But for the most part, people are actually pretty good.
Do we know? Is there a number of piping plovers that we have in New Hampshire? I mean, is it 50? Is it 1,000? Is it 500?
Yeah, actually, we had a record year last year. And you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
It was 11.
Jeez.
11 pairs.
11?
11 pairs in New Hampshire. So along the whole Atlantic coast from North Carolina to Nova Scotia, there's fewer than 2,000 pairs of plovers. So that's, you know, when
wow.
I say that they're fairly threatened.
So how many eggs per clutch do they have, and how many of those hatch?
So they'll have 4 eggs per clutch typically, and they usually all hatch. But then the big threat is once the chicks hatch, they can't fly for three and a half weeks, and they're just running around on the beach. They don't stay in the nest.
Oh.
They're called precocial chick.
Yep.
So they run around and forage, and the adults will herd them around the beach. And then there's predators. There's people on the beach occasionally, but there's, you know, if there's any vehicles on the beach, they can easily get run over.
Oh,
so we have worked with the towns to you know, mitigate that.
What's the biggest predator that would prey on them?
Well, it's really kind of a take your pick. There's, you know, gulls will do it, crows, you know, foxes, skunks mm-hmm. will go after the eggs, cats, if there are cats on the beach, feral cats, dogs, just wanting to play. You know, a dog sees a little chick running around, just wants to doesn't want to eat it, just wants to go think it's a toy, and will so you know, dogs on the beach can be a problem as well.
See, I think people think crows and seagulls are carrion feeders, not killers.
Right. Yeah. Fortunately, we don't have a crow problem like some places in the on the Atlantic coast where they on our beach. I think it's because there isn't really much of a tree line nearby,
mm-hmm.
so there's not really many perching areas. And I've seen crows, but not not extensively. Whereas other places, the crows are so smart they'll actually watch the monitors, the people that are monitoring the birds, and learn where the nests are because
oh,
they watch where the monitors are and they'll key in on them. Yeah, it's really a problem
creepy.
For some areas.
I think I think I saw a Stephen King movie about that. So why, and we're going to take a call in a minute. Why is the population going down along the eastern seaboard? Is it habitat or what's going on?
Yeah, well, it's actually going up now slowly, but it did go down because of habitat loss was the primary reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, beaches are very desirable places for humans. Historically, you know, back in the 30s, before the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918. So even prior to that, birds were hunted for their feathers. So that kind of put the decline way down. And then as they came back up, beaches became even more popular. So it's really been a multifaceted reason that they've been declining. But through all the conservation efforts for the past, you know, 20 years, they've really rebounded fairly well, and they're getting close to the baseline of where we might consider them recovered. That's not going to be for a while, but they're getting close to that point. So that's good.
Heading in the right direction.
I know.
Yeah.
That's what we need to do. All right, let's take a question. Good morning, New Hampshire. You're on the line. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is Dave calling from Hopkinton.
Hey, Dave.
Hi, Dave. Go ahead and ask your question.
I was out four-wheeling along some backwater a couple of weeks ago, and there was a snake that clearly he was on a log out in the water sunning himself like you'd see a turtle do. And so he had to swim to get there. He was a solid copper color with a black head, and I can't seem to figure out what kind of snake it is.
Okay.
And here's where Brandon comes in and says, aha!
Yeah, so most likely, it was a northern water snake, and I'll tell you that they are very variable in their color and pattern. And I've seen some snakes that have been almost orange based on maybe something that was in the water. But so they are very variable. Sometimes they can be solid black. Sometimes they can be tannish colored with some reddish stripes, reddish banding. But they're usually in the water or around the water. And without having a photo, that's probably what I would say it is. But other snakes will be near the water as well. But
now, is that an activity that they are prone to do, going out on a log or a rock and laying out and doing some rays?
Yes, especially this time of year. We're getting there, finally the first warm days, they'll bask and warm up their bodies. So certainly water snake activity.
Cool.
All right, awesome. Okay. Well, thank you so much for
There's your answer, Dave.
Thanks very much.
All right. Look at that. See, you educated somebody. That's good.
There you go.
I love it.
No, man, that's
a big
cool.
part of my job.
So we're going to have to take a break in a minute and then come back. But, you know, I'm looking at the endangered list, and you can check this out. You can go to wildlife.state.nh.us and punch it up. You can see endangered and threatened wildlife in New Hampshire. I mean, let's face it, with COVID-19 and work and blah, 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 there aren't a lot of people that care about the American brook lamprey, the dwarf wedge mussel, the least tern. How do you make this stuff relevant and important to people so that they do care?
Well, we do a lot of outreach when we can. We work with a lot of communities, so we work with a lot of conservation commissions, a lot of our partners, like the Nature Conservancy, like New Hampshire Audubon, they have outreach as well, so they can put forth some of our message. It's really a continual, these animals are there. They're never going to be where we want them to be unless we can do some work for them. So even with, you know, people right now are really enjoying the outdoors, right? So with this COVID-19, they're really,
right.
you know, place people are flocking to the outdoors. So if they want to see some of these animals or know that they exist, you know, it's important to just let them know that, you know, they're still part of the environment. They're, you know, for your enjoyment, you know, you might want to know that they're out there or maybe see one day. So we really try to push that message if we can, but it is a difficult sell sometimes when it's, you know, when there's a major human issue like right now. But, you know, we are constantly working. We have lots of federal grant money that we're putting towards these species, and we think for good reason.
Well, now, and again, we'll take a break in a second, but from an ecosystem point of view, eastern hognose snake, okay, is one of the endangered, is on the endangered list. What happens to the ecosystem if, for whatever reason, the eastern hognose snake disappears out of New Hampshire? What are we losing?
Well, for just one species, it's not going to be catastrophic. Everybody would like to think that's the reason, but when you start losing multiple species, we're losing different services like predator-prey relationships. So they're focusing on amphibians, but really it's difficult to say exactly what we're losing when it's just one species. If we lose a whole guild of species, like if you lost all of our snakes,
yep,
for example,
mm-hmm,
so they're, you know, preying on rodents, they're preying on insects, they're preying on other snakes, they're preying on frogs, toads. So there's going to be a shift in, it might not be immediate, and it's not going to be immediate, but over time there's going to be a shift in those prey densities that the snakes would, yeah, keep in check. And over time, I don't know exactly what the result would be, but there would be, you know, more,
yeah,
of those prey items and potentially, you know, problems as we work down the road. But one species, it's tough to say, you know.
Well, I mean, you start losing the little brown bat, the eastern small-footed bat, the northern long-eared bat, the tricolor bat. We know that the bats eat like four times their weight or 10 times their weight, whatever it is,
mm-hmm,
nightly, in bugs. You take them, mm-hmm, out of the equation, uh-oh, we got a problem.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe, you know, it's been several years now that we've lost those species, and, you know, I don't know who's been doing the research on insect populations, but there's certainly, I would expect there to be, you know, an increase in certain species out there that are, and maybe they're nuisance species for humans, so that can be a direct draw to human populations as far as, you know, aesthetics and nuisance. But
yep,
for the environment, you know, those pests are certainly going to do something, you know.
And by the way, we do have to, we're going to take the break now. I'll come back on the other side. We're going to keep chatting. But I also want to say that you listening can learn how to count bats in an online training seminar, Fish and Game.
Ooh.
That's going to be coming up. Yeah. So seeing as I was talking about bats, let me throw that in as well. 8:49, back with more after this. Oh, come on, I had to do that.
That's perfect. That's great.
As I was saying, if you have bats in the barn or around your house, New Hampshire wildlife biologists would love to hear from you. Citizen science volunteers are needed more than ever. Thursday, June 4th, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Is it Sandy Houghton? Is that? Did I say,
yes,
the name right?
Okay. Sandra Houghton, or she goes by Sandy, is our bat biologist.
Okay. And Haley Andriozzi from UNH Cooperative Extension is going to lead an online introduction to the different bat species found in the Granite States. An hour-long virtual training. It's going to include an overview of bats and species ID and how to participate in New Hampshire Bat Counts Project, which helps monitor summer bat colonies. And, you know, it helps the biologist fill in data gaps. I mean, like you said, there's only 10 in the division. They can't be everywhere. So if you'd like to be involved with us, you can go to naturegroupie.org, or you can contact Haley at haley.andriozzi@unh.edu, or you can call 862-5327. And if you don't get any of those numbers, go to fishnh.com,
mm-hmm,
and click on the newsroom, and there's a press release there. You can see it. But if you'd like to get involved, you could do it that way. But anyway, Brendan Clifford with us, the snake dude. Already had one one question. Look at that.
Yep.
See, I get creeped out by snakes, but just, you know, I don't think it's the snakes per se. It's usually I'm not looking for them, and I don't see them until I'm about to stand on them.
Well, right.
Yeah.
And then the whole thought comes like racing to your mind, and of course, jump is the first thing.
Yeah. And scream like a girl is second.
Well, okay,
but okay,
maybe,
yeah, I know. That happens. Did I see a story about some timber rattler that was caught and released?
Not this year, but we've had something come up in the past, yep, where we've had a snake in a neighborhood that we relocated. So it does happen occasionally.
Do we have? I didn't know we had timber rattlers in New Hampshire.
We do. We have one population or one population center, and we keep it a low profile if we can. We try to keep it a secret for the protection of the snakes mostly, because we don't want people going out there and looking for them or harassing them.
Right.
But they are they're probably our most endangered species in the state, or one of them. So we have one population in New Hampshire. There's a couple in Vermont, a few more in Massachusetts, but they're very rare when you get in the Northeast here.
So was Rattlesnake Island on Winnipesaukee like a hotbed of rattlesnake activity?
I don't know if it was a hotbed, but they were out there. I'm not sure exactly how they got out there or what, but there's a lot of rattlesnake-named features in New Hampshire that probably historically had rattlesnakes. We never had an abundance of them, I don't think, but they were certainly south of the White Mountains, scattered around in different rocky hillsides.
Can rattlesnakes swim?
Yep, they can swim.
Okay.
And really, any snake can swim. Yep, if they needed to. Yep.
Ooh, gross. That's not.
I was
you're
gonna
not
say,
comforting me here.
Well, all of a sudden, I'm out of the water walking on
yeah.
it. I'm running
damn.
On the
right.
water.
Damn.
Yeah.
Well, where they are, they don't need to swim too much. They're pretty. It's a pretty kind of secretive location. It's not remote per se, but it's most people will never come into contact with them.
So, I know we have some turtles. What is it, the Eastern Box Turtle and the Blandings, I think, are on the list. And we have David Carroll on, the turtle guy.
Okay.
And David is, passionate about it. And he said if we lose them, then what we're losing is a harbinger of the environment. And he's talking about loss of habitat and water quality and a whole lot of things go into it. It's not just one thing, is it?
It's not. Really, these animals are they're here because they need certain requirements, habitat requirements, and if you lose them, it means you're losing these other things that, are important for not only for animals but also for people and for our environment. So it's not a good indicator if you lose a species.
Now, why, my question is, deer, when deer, I have been in New England forever, and it was wooded, now it's become urban. Deer have evolved into becoming urban creatures. They can handle it. A lot of species have evolved to accommodate pavement and bridges and subdivisions and blah, blah, blah. What prevents certain species from evolving to accommodate the changes?
Well, some species, it's a lot based on movement, I think, especially for these turtles and for these snakes, and it's also habitat. But so some species are more of I'm going to paint a broad brush here and say generalist species, where they can exploit a lot of different conditions, and sometimes human environments will create conditions that are favorable for them, like for deer. Early successional habitats are kind of can be rich in some, young sprouting vegetation, where we have a lot of that around human developments, and we have ornamentals that they can browse on.
Yep.
So for other animals, like say for the Blandings turtle, for example, so they, live in the wetlands, which fine, the wetlands aren't development, that's great, but they also move great distances from these wetlands. And when they move, they're trucking across land, across roads, and they're just, they're slow, they're prone to being hit.
Okay.
By cars. So some of these, it's really kind of, for some animals they're generalists, but a lot of it's case-by-case basis where they have certain behavioral attributes that, are not conducive to human landscapes.
That makes sense. All right. Hey, well, look, Brendan Clifford, wildlife diversity biologist, non-game endangered wildlife program. You can check it out. Go online, fishnh.com, and click on non-game. You can learn more about and make a contribution if you'd like. See, Brendan, I told you this was easy. So
it was easy. Yes,
yeah, so come on back. We'll do it again.